Between the 40s and 70s, Robert was growing up in Iowa. But nothing about his life was easy. There was a lot of instability, and soon it started to translate into his life. Harmless stunts like robbery were ignored until one day Robert learned to hide a little too well. For years, he kidnapped, brutalized, and murdered women. But how many? To this day, nobody's quite sure. His meticulous process helped him conceal things a little too well. This is the story of Robert Ben Rhodes, a man who became famous as the truck stop killer. And this is the Serial Zodiac, and I am your host, Carly Ramsey. Ben Rhodes was born on November 22, 1945, in Council Bluffs, Iowa. This guy was one of the most terrifying figures in the world of true crime. Born on November 22, 1945, he falls right on the cusp between Scorpio and Sagittarius. Now, his zodiac sign might have played a role in his horrific crimes. So, Rhodes' birth date places him on the borderline between Scorpio and Sagittarius. People born on this cusp can exhibit traits from both signs, which makes for a complex personality. Scorpio is known for being intense, secretive, and highly perceptive. They can be deeply passionate, but also possess a darker, more obsessive side. Scorpios are often seen as mysterious, with an uncanny ability to read people and situations, making them master manipulators when they want to be. Rhodes' ability to lure victims and keep his horrific activities hidden for so long might have been linked to these Scorpio traits. Now, let's add in a bit of Sagittarius energy. Sagittarians are adventurous, love freedom, and can be quite reckless. They're known for their wanderlust and desire to explore new horizons. For Rhodes, this could translate into his life as a long-haul truck driver, constantly on the move and seeking out new victims. Sagittarius's shadow side can include a lack of empathy and a tendency to be reckless and irresponsible, which would certainly describe Rose's behavior. Combining these traits, you get the picture of someone who is not only driven by dark, obsessive desires, but also the freedom-loving, adventurous streak to act on them without fear of being tied down. His Scorpio side may have fueled the sadistic, controlling aspects of his crimes, while his Sagittarius side gave him the means to roam freely across the country, evading capture. But let's be clear, astrology is just one way to look at this complex and terrifying individual. While it might provide some interesting insights to his personality, it does not excuse his actions or fully explain the horrors he committed. Robert Rose's life and crimes are a chilling reminder of the darkest capabilities of human nature, with or without the star's influence. So, as we go on this story, what do you think? Can the cusp of Scorpio and Sagittarius really paint a picture of someone like Robert Rhodes? Or are his actions beyond the scope of zodiac analysis? Let's keep the conversation going and stay thoughtful as we explore this dark story together. So, according to the cliche, his father had been gone his entire life, fighting with the U.S. Army in West Germany. And when he returned, Robert's father found employment as a firefighter. Life for young Robert was as normal as can be. Yet, despite the appearance of a schrobotic and bonny childhood, Robert was faced with a harsh social fact. He was constantly tormented at school, and he attempted to behave like a normal student through heavy involvement in school activities, such as football, wrestling, and even singing in the choir, being a member of the French club. All of this got him into serious trouble at the age of 16 when he was arrested for tampering with a vehicle. At 17, he got arrested once again for public fighting the day after his high school graduation. So Robert joined the Marines Corps in 1964. Also in that year, his family was struck by two devastating events. A father jailed for some serious crime and he took his own life while he was awaiting trial. And as for Robert, his military career would prove to be quite short. He got dishonorably discharged for his involvement in a robbery. The years that followed were highlighted by constant struggle. He tried to attend college, but soon dropped out on the way to graduation after, in part because of his inability to repress the reasons for his discharge on his enlistment form. And he also tried to start a career in law enforcement and was turned down because of his military record. He married three times and he had one son with his first wife. He had worked at stores and supermarkets and then in warehouses, and ultimately he had found his way into the life of a long-haul trucker. The 80s were not bright years for Robert, though. He had gotten involved in the BDSM scene, and according to his third wife, Deborah, he had become abusive. She would later claim that he was abusive to her verbally, physically, and as well as sexually. This part of his life told something about the darkness that was just beginning to peer out. The prelude of the life of Robert might not have hinted at the darkness that was about to be unleashed. He participated in different activities of school, and he tried to fit in and keep busy, but in spite of these facts, he always came in the path of trouble. So the trouble that Robert's father had gotten in, he was actually on trial for molesting a 7-year-old girl. And I feel like whenever you take your life, it's the ultimate like act of, I'm not going to take responsibility for what I just did. Especially not like, there are different reasons why, but in Robert's dad's case, I feel like it was his way of saying he's not going to take responsibility for what he did. So I feel like that really had an impact on Robert's life.
About 3 a.m. on April 1st, 1990, Arizona State Trooper Mike Miller observed a Peterbilt semi-tractor with its emergency flashers on. sitting on the roadway beside westbound lanes of Interstate 10, a short distance outside of Casa Grande. Curious and slightly concerned, Miller decided to investigate further, an act that would eventually lead to disaster. The door of the truck's cab was open, and inside was something that would be forever in Miller's head. A nude woman who was handcuffed and shackled to the inside of the cab. She was screaming in a fit as he tried to console her. He was telling her that everything was going to be all right. And the driver even told him that he had a gun, and he gave the gun to Miller. Trying to keep his cool, Miller continued to handcuff the man, later identified to be Robert Ben Rhodes, and secured him inside the patrol car. Going back to the woman, Miller observed she was badly hurt, with welts and cuts all over her body, consisting of a horse bridle strap around her neck. She was scared to death, begging Miller to keep Robert away from her. It wasn't long after that Miller finally felt the true level of danger posed by Robert. And as Miller was attempting to comfort the woman, Robert had already worked his handcuffs from behind him, and he had put them in front of him, and he had unbuckled his seatbelt. And now, if Miller hadn't been proactive enough, Robert could have easily kept his exit. And this terrifying scene could have gotten out of control even more. So Robert actually had a handcuff key in his pocket, and that's what he was trying to get. So had Miller not walked back to the car in that second, he would have been gone. So the help came in the person of Officer Robert Gax of the Casa Grande Police Department. Both men removed the woman, who was escorted down to the police station. Once there, the 27-year-old unnamed woman could at least begin to feel safe. She explained to Detective Rick Barnhart that Robert had taken her from a truck stop near Phoenix. He'd given her a ride. She'd been sleeping when he'd shackled her to the bed of his truck and tortured her with items from a well-organized briefcase. Speaking through the videotape, the woman relayed the horror. Robert, the CB radio handle Whips and Chains, had tortured her through all the daylight hours. The marks of his cruelty were evident on her body, and while she said she had been saved just in time before he raped her, Barnhart wasn't sure. The condition of her injuries indicated otherwise. From the contents of Robert's briefcase, which quite obviously held the tools of torture, Barnhart knew they were dealing with a serial predator. That the rape kit was in such good condition testified that Robert had done this for some time, and only increased Barnhart's suspicion, which his coolness during the interview. The fact that Robert could present himself as normal or even likable as a person made him all the more dangerous. Robert was charged with aggravated assault, sexual assault, and unlawful imprisonment. And Barnhart put out a nationwide alert and called the Houston Police Department, which is where Robert resided. In no time, he managed to establish contact with Detective R.E. Bormard of Houston, who gave him the information of a case similar to this one. Robert had kept a lady, 18 years of age, for 2 weeks and tortured her in the same way. He managed to escape when Robert forgot to lock one of her handcuffs. 18-year-old Shanna Holt managed to escape and report the incident to the police. They had more than enough evidence against him, yet Shanna chose not to press charges. "I don't see any good in filing charges," explained Shanna in an interview where she was speaking to the police. "It's just going to be my word against his."
She was terrified of Robert all the more because for two torturous weeks, she had ridden in his truck with the cab turned into a torture chamber for victims. She did tell police about how he had held her captive for weeks and he talked at great length about killing her. But when Houston police had brought her face to face with Robert, she had been too terrified to point him out, fearing there weren't enough officers to protect her from his wrath. By this time, there was no direct evidence to connect Robert to either of the deaths in Illinois or Texas. But the pattern of behavior, a systematic approach to torture, and a chilling level of control over his victims was keeping with the sexual sadist personality. FBI Special Agent Bob Lee had to read the reports and recognized the signs. Sexual sadists frequently keep so-called trophies on record of their crimes, and Lee hoped to seize Robert's Houston apartment for evidence. Equipped with a search warrant, on April 6, 1990, a raid was launched against Robert's apartment, leading to the discovery of a treasure trove of bondage materials, women's clothes, and also hundreds of photographs, the most disturbing being a young woman with short hair, always shackled and handcuffed, and obviously in a state of advanced long-range decomposition, indicating long-term abuse. He also knew that within that collection of photographs was another representative of an often abused victim. Representation of an often abused victim. The intuition of Lee was confirmed in the careful littering of even the torture tools and the evidences in the photographs, in detailing a man who was truly evil, perfecting his skills as a sadistic killer over time. One of the items seized contained a macrobic message and scribbled images that would send chills down one spine. Quote, "Ricky is a dead man," end quote, right beside an image of a gun and drips of blood. However, another gut-churning case would reveal itself as the investigation grew deeper. Now, in early 1991, an Illinois farmer found the body of 14-year-old Regina Walters in the loft of his barn. Regina had disappeared in early February of 1990, last seen with her boyfriend, Ricky Lee Jones, just outside of Houston. So, Regina had, she was like, I would say, I would describe Regina as kind of like a troubled teen. So, her mom and her dad had split, and for a while, Regina had lived with her dad, and her mom was basically kind of begging her to come back. So, the particular weekend that Regina had disappeared, she had just came back to her mom's, and her mom was going to visit, I think it was either like a family member or a friend, and she usually would kind of make Regina come with her. But since she'd just gotten back, she really didn't want to do anything to upset Regina. So she let Regina stay at home. Her mom went the weekend. She came back. Regina was fine. And she had asked her what she had did that weekend. She just said she had babysat for some neighbors. And then kind of all of a sudden, Regina was like, oh, I forgot to give them their key. Like, let me go give them their key. So she went in to go supposedly give the neighbors the key, and she like never came back. So her mom kind of reported her missing, started putting out like missing persons flyers, and they eventually had caught up and figured out kind of like, oh, like she was with her boyfriend. And then they were talking to the boyfriend's friends, and they basically were like, Yeah, they saw the missing persons posters and they left because Ricky was 18 and Regina was 14. And Ricky was on parole and he didn't want to get in trouble. So both of them left. So, yeah. That's how Regina went missing. So once she was found in the barn, she had been horribly tortured and her hair had been cut very short, which was Robert's signature. When the FBI found photos of her in his apartment, they connected the dots to which one of Robert's murders involved Regina. In the photographs, she was found in various stages of undress, with the photographic expression of fear on her face. All of these photos were time-stamped to coincide exactly with the crime scene in Illinois, where she was discovered. It was coming together, piecing the puzzle of a predator who had traveled multiple state lines, leaving a trail of victims in his wake. Her boyfriend, 18-year-old Ricky Jones, was also killed. His partial skeleton was found near Hurlington in May tw on May 26th of 1990. He had been shot in the head. Agents Lee and Young meticulously worked together to link Robert to his crimes and, in most cases, believed that he had murdered more people than they could pin on him. Their work had the final outcome of Robert pleading guilty to the murder of Regina Walters, and he was sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison without the possibility of parole. However, this wasn't the only murder he had admitted to. So when they were trying to get him for Regina's murder, they were kind of having to work against the clock. Robert was about to be up for parole for the girl that he had kidnapped and raped. He was about to be up for parole. So I think he had gotten like 10 years in jail for that, if I'm not mistaken. And he was getting out sooner because he was like the perfect inmate. So he was getting released early. And so they were kind of really having to work quickly. So they had all this evidence against him for the Regina case, and he kind of just knew he wasn't going to get out of it. And he knew that they were also going to go for the death penalty. So in order to avoid the death penalty, Robert ended up just pleading guilty to Regina's murder. But they didn't have enough evidence to pin Ricky's murder on Robert. The only thing that they really had was "Ricky is a dead man" written down in the book. So it was a cold October day in Millard County, Utah, for deer hunters to stumble upon the skeletal remains tucked away in a trash bin. There was nothing with the remains to give a clue to their origin, so she was referred to as Jane Doe 1 and sat as such for more than the next 13 years. Then, in May of 2003, forensic scientists at the University of Arizona, possessing a unique piece of available evidence, a one-of-a-kind jaw that had distinguishable dental work between the two molars, eyes of the teeth, were able to make X-ray comparisons and realized that she was 24-year-old Patricia Candace Walsh. Patricia, 20, and her 26-year-old husband, Douglas Scott Zawowski, were from Seattle and they went missing after they left the city in 1989, never to be seen again. In January of 1990, his remains were located near Interstate 10 in Ozona, Texas. It wasn't until 1992 that he was identified. Finally, Patricia was identified in 2003, but it was not finally proven if their case could be solved until the Utah State Police investigators contacted the Texas Rangers with a long shot. The killer could finally be identified. Robert confessed that he had picked up Patricia and Douglas, who were hitchhiking, and Robert claimed to murder Douglas almost immediately, and he dumped his body in Sutton County, Texas. Patricia's fate was even worse. Robert kept her captive for over a week, torturing her until he finally murdered her and left her body in Millard County, Utah. Robert's method of operation was clinical. He would use his profession as an over-the-road driver to facilitate his crimes of the predator. Robert would pick up hapless hitchhikers, pretending he would only give them a lift, which he would convert into the trip from hell, and the sleeper of his truck became his own personal chambers of horrors, a sleeping cubicle of which he imprisoned his victims for hours on end. Patricia and her husband, Douglas, were celebrating like their honeymoon, and they were hitchhiking to go to a festival. And they had gotten there successfully, and on their way back is when they went missing. Their family actually reported them missing. They just really never knew what happened to them. So them finding them and understanding what happened to them, it gave the family somewhat of closure, knowing what happened to them, because before they didn't know if they were dead or alive. And honestly, they had stayed unidentified for a really long time.
The analysis for some of Robert's trucking logs, which had been conducted at the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, confirmed that he was in and around the times multiple unsolved murders had taken place. The scariest part was that he may have caused dozens of deaths, with most of the bodies still unaccounted for. Experts in the field who studied Robert observed that he, like many sexual sadists, developed in his activities over a period of time. By early 1990, he was abducting and murdering at a rate of about 3 victims per month. His job as an over-the-road trucker provided the perfect cover, allowing him to travel across the country without attracting attention. The Robert case was very important in learning cases for the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Unit, which was growing increasingly concerned about sexual sadists. Most of them happened to be white males, and they would normally start with the lesser crimes and graduate to the bigger ones. Due to their systematic nature and ability to easily fit into society, they are that much more dangerous. His double life was best explained by his third wife, Debbie. She went on to explain how he manipulated her into what he said was kinky sex, but it was so much more than that. Her testimony went on to show how controlling he is over people and the psychological trauma he has inflicted on them, including his own family members. The more investigators reconstructed the pieces of Robert's life, the more they came to the view of the enormity of his crimes. The vast number of potential victims was horrifying, and the level of his brutality left an impact on researchers doing the study. Robert had eluded identification and detection for over 20 years, all while leading a double life and wreaking havoc through the nation. For officers such as Barnard and Miller, this was enough to chronicle the face of evil that can inhabit the skin. Charismatic beyond belief, Robert had a way of revealing his deceitful nature and then wording his responses to appear to be under the most innocent of magnifying glasses. Robert Ben Rhodes' arrest and conviction brought some form of justice for the victims, but the full extent of his crimes may never be known. The skeletal remains along his routes hinted at the lives he took,
the families left with no answers, and the communities that will forever be scarred because of him. As the case wrapped up, the agents reflected on the deeply cutting nature of Robert's crime. Meticulous work done in connecting all the dots, harrowing interviews of survivors, and the relentless chase of justice, and more. Those efforts stood between Robert and his next victim, perhaps bringing some peace to their memories of those who had been taken away. In September 1992, Robert Ben Rhodes pleaded guilty to first-degree murder to avoid facing the death penalty and was sentenced to life in prison. This appeal was his third in a case with a complicated legal history. Robert initially argued that the court made a mistake by not allowing him to withdraw his guilty plea after his second appeal. He also challenged the constitutionality of the statute under which he was sentenced, referring to the Supreme Court's decision in Abbott v. New Jersey. Before accepting his guilty plea, the courtroom held a hearing to confirm the facts of the case. They reviewed the evidence presented to the grand jury that had indicted Robert, and it was a rundown of everything he had been accused of. At the guilty plea hearing, the court informed Robert that he could be sentenced to life without parole if his actions were found to be exceptionally brutal and heinous. Robert later filed a motion to withdraw his plea and reduce his sentence, arguing that his plea and sentence were invalid without a certificate of compliance. The court denied this motion after hearing, leading to his first appeal. In his first appeal, Robert claimed his guilty plea was invalid because his attorney didn't file a certificate of compliance with the Supreme Court Rule 604D. The appellate court reversed the decision without addressing the merits and reprimanded the case to allow Robert to plea again. On reprimand, Robert filed a post-conviction petition, which was denied, and he appealed again. In his second appeal, Robert argued that the court should have appointed counsel to represent him. The appellate court agreed and sent the case back to determine if Robert wanted representation. On reprimand, his counsel argued that the state violated the plea agreement, but the court dismissed the motion without considering the merits. Counsel provided an offer of proof, but the court denied the motion, stating that the plea agreement was within permissible bounds. Robert then appealed again, claiming the court misinterpreted the appeal mandate. He argued that his September 1994 letter should be treated as a post-conviction petition. The appellate court disagreed, stating that the circuit court had followed its mandate correctly. The court determined that a guilty plea was a knowing admission of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, so Robert couldn't claim his apparate rights were violated. Apprende, which deals with sentence enhancements based on judicial findings rather than jury findings, didn't apply since Robert was aware that a life sentence was possible when he pleaded guilty. The court ensured all constitutional rights were protected during the plea process. The appellate court upheld the statute as constitutional, affirming that Robert's sentence was justly awarded. They cited the thorough basis established during the plea hearing and the legal processes followed. By pleading guilty, Robert waived several constitutional rights, including the rights to a jury trial. He fully understood the consequences of his plea, negating his claim of rights being violated under the Apprendi. The court held that Robert's plea and sentence were lawful and confirmed the judgment of the lower court. In 2005, prosecutors finally dropped the capital murder and aggravated kidnapping charges against Robert Ben Rhodes in Miller County's 4th District Court. Instead, Robert was supposed to face trial in Texas for the murder he committed in Utah. Before being extradited to Utah in early 2005, Robert was already serving a life sentence without parole at the Pontiac Correctional Center in Illinois. They planned to send him back there soon. In Utah, Robert was charged with the murder of 24-year-old Candace Walsh, whose severely decomposed body was discovered by deer hunters 22 miles south of Fillmore in October 1990. However, Utah dropped the charges on the instance of the victim's families so that both of the cases could be tried in Texas. So Texas was to begin the process of extraditing him to their state to face murder charges for both Patricia and Douglas and Walter and Jones. If convicted in Texas, Robert could have faced the death penalty. Prosecutor Brent Berkeley explained that having the same witnesses for both murders testify only once made more sense. It's in the best interest of justice and the victims' families, he said. Berkeley expressed no regrets about extraditing Robert to Utah and then sending him back to Illinois over a year later. It was worth it. I think we'd do it again, he said. This case is different from most homicides. Most of the evidence is from out of state and from different agencies. It's kind of a complicated case. Under Texas law, both murders can be prosecuted because Patricia's ordeal began with her kidnapping there, Berkeley noted. Utah, however, could only prosecute one murder. Court documents reveal that Patricia's family was concerned about having to go through multiple hearings and strongly preferred to proceed in Texas. Berkeley added that he was unsure about Utah's prosecutor's involvement in the Texas trial. In the end, Robert pleaded guilty to both of the murders on the condition that the death penalty be dropped, and he was then given a second life sentence. Right now, he remains in Merritt Correctional Center in Chester, Illinois, serving his life sentence without parole. A woman from Thunderchild First Nation stumbled upon something online that could potentially reopen Robert's case and bring out even more victims than he had admitted to. Back in 2015, Pamela Milken, while browsing Facebook, came across a post that made her exclaim to her boyfriend, "Hey, that's me." Naturally, he was skeptical. Milken, at the age of 52, explained that she saw a post asking for help identifying a young Indigenous woman in a photo found in a semi-truck of Robert Ben Rhodes, infamously known as the truck stop killer. Pamela Milken was first mentioned in a 2012 GQ article by Vanessa, who had also written about escaping a trucker like Robert. In the article, retired FBI investigator Mark Young handed Velsic a photo of a young girl, possibly Native American, sitting in Robert's truck. The girl was wearing a gray hoodie and her eyes were partly closed, as if she were stoned or sleepy. Young mentioned the photo was found at the end of the same roll of film pictures of Regina Walters, even though the incidents happened 5 years apart. Milken instantly recognized herself in that photo. She recalled hitchhiking from Thunderchild First Nation to Sakawashkin in spring of 1985, trying to reach her brother in Winnipeg. After getting several rides, she encountered a semi-truck driver she believes was Robert in White City, just outside Regina. As the sun set, she stuck out her thumb, hoping for a ride. A flat-nosed white semi-truck stopped, and she ran to catch it. The driver, who introduced himself as Robert, helped her with her heavy bag and took a picture of her just as she was climbing into the truck. When she asked why he took the picture, he claimed it was for his protection in case she stole something from him. During the ride, Robert told her he was heading to Florida and invited her to join him.
He then pointed to the sign on his dashboard that read, "Cash, grass, or ass. No one rides for free." Understanding the implication, Milken said she had consensual sex in the back of the truck. She was eventually dropped off safely at the bus depot in Winnipeg. Fast forward 30 years, Milken saw the Facebook post and knew it was her in the photo, but she didn't have any photos from the time to prove it. Then she discovered a photo of herself from the period on her niece's wall. Milken reached out to the FBI and the RCMP in St. Paul, where she was enrolled in a camp preparation program. The RCMP confirmed they would send a constable to speak with her and verify her identity. Milken was understandably shaken, but wanted to assure authorities that she's okay. APTN reached out to the FBI in Houston, former FBI investigator Mark Young, and Milken's niece for further information, but nothing more has been revealed to the public up till this point. I hope that you enjoyed listening to the case of Robert Ben Rhodes. I know that I thoroughly, I wouldn't say enjoyed, but I was very interested in learning about his crimes and just honestly kind of understanding how he got away with it for so long. And I hope that you enjoyed learning about that too. But I just want to thank you guys for listening to this episode. And thank you so, so much for tuning in every week. I can't wait to see you guys next week for an episode with my very special guest. And I also would love it if you guys would subscribe to my YouTube channel and sign up for my email list so that way you can be the first to know whenever I drop episodes. Other than that, guys, stay safe, stay vigilant, and stay suspicious. Bye.